I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of the show with us, so please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who you think deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teachersLounge@niu.edu. Today on the show, it is my conversation with Jeremy Benson. He's a STEM educator and lab manager with the physics department at Northern Illinois University. And Jeremy's enthusiasm for math and science is really contagious. So when students show a small spark of curiosity about the world around them, he knows how to fan the flames.
I've compared it to listening to a song in a language you don't understand. You can hear the melody, you can appreciate the beauty, you can enjoy it. It could even be your favorite song. But if you learn that language, then all of a sudden you know what the song is about. You understand the subcontext, you understand the true meaning of it, you get it on a deeper level. So we can appreciate the world around us just like that song, but it is written in the language of math and science. And if we can actually appreciate it on that level, all of a sudden we start noticing things that weren't there before. We start appreciating on a much deeper level, and it gains a much more sort of robust existence. And so that, to me, is the true beauty of it.
We had an awesome conversation about haunted physics labs, space observatories, teaching science across the world, the chemistry of kids in a classroom, and why he thinks many students misunderstand what science actually is. It's a great conversation, so I figured let's just cut to the chase and get right to it with STEM educator Jeremy Benson. And what is the Haunted Physics Lab for people that don't know?
So the Haunted Physics Lab is, like I said, the thing that kind of STEM Fest was born from. It originally started with my boss, Patty Sievert. Just did a much smaller outreach program through the physics department, which we called the Frontier Physics Outreach Program at that time. And she would go out to schools and do demonstration programs. And one of the things that she started doing was this Haunted Physics Lab, which was sort of an open house event where we would invite the public to come into the physics building. And we would set up some of these hands-on demonstration stations that we would have. So hands-on activities, experiments that kids can do, and then some things that are more hands-off but still very interesting to see. Like some of the high voltage things and stuff like that. So really to just kind of get the community interested, get them in the building, and it just became very popular. By the eighth year, which is about when things switched over and they started doing STEM Fest, I think they had something like 800 or 900 people that came through the building, which is a lot of people. We had a little less than 100 when we did it last year, which was the first year that we brought it back to the physics building. So I am looking forward to having over 100 this year, and hopefully it will continue growing, maybe not quite as fast as it did back then since we also have STEM Fest.
Sure.
But if it does, I'm not going to complain.
Have the hauntings evolved a lot?
Oh, yes. We've continued to add new demonstrations, new exhibits. Some of my very favorite things are those high-voltage things, the musical Tesla coil. We've had for some time now, but that was one of my very favorite additions. That's probably my personal favorite toy.
And again, for people that don't know.
So a musical Tesla coil is. What a Tesla coil is, it's a high-voltage device. It generates very high voltages, which is what causes sparks. Whenever we see electricity jump through the air, electricity is lazy. It does not like moving through the air. It does not like doing any more work than it has to. So moving through wires is very easy. It likes that. Jumping through the air, you've got to have a lot of push or a lot of pull on that electricity. So that voltage, the high voltage, basically means a lot of push or a lot of pull, or even a little bit of both. A lot of them go back and forth if it's AC. So the Tesla coil is a device for creating extremely high voltages, hundreds of thousands of volts, which allows us to make these very nice long, foot-long discharges, sparks. And then the musical one actually has like a strobe machine. So like a strobe light that flashes on very quickly, that spark actually appears and disappears very rapidly. Too fast for us to see it, like a strobe light in the Haunted Physics Lab, but we can then hear the effect that that sound has. So the faster that spark is turning on and off, the faster that vibration is happening. So the air is vibrating. That's what sound is.
Yeah.
So as we increase the frequency of the spark, it increases the frequency of the sound that we hear. so we can play it like a musical instrument. So I actually have a little computer box that it hooks up to, which tells it exactly how fast to go for exactly the right amount of time so that we can play songs.
Ooh, so like any song?
Any song that I can program into it. So it plays what's called MIDI files,
Which
is like the old style ringtones before we had the actual recordings of songs that played, where it just has the information on what notes to play.
Yeah.
Nothing about what it should sound like, no instrumentation, just play an A for this long, play a B for this long sequentially. And so it uses those types of files. So if I can find a file online that someone's already made, which is usually pretty easy to do, then I'm set. However, I do also have a lot of musical experience. I am familiar with sheet music, so I also have a program where I can just plug the notes in on the sheet music, and it will create the MIDI file for me. So I have also designed a few of our own songs.
Oh, no kidding. I was going to say, if you had any go-to songs that you like to do.
One of my favorites that we've put together ourselves is me and my coworker, Petey, at the time, who was a huge, huge Cubs fan. And so when the Cubs went all the way, we programmed it to play Go Cubs Go. And every school that we went to for the next couple of weeks after that, we would have the Tesla coil singing Go Cubs Go, and we get all the kids singing along with it, and it was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's fun. A tough one for a White Sox fan like myself, but that's okay.
I think everybody for a couple of weeks was willing to join in the party. Fair.
It was a good time for everyone. It was 108 years they deserved it, right?
Exactly.
And like I mentioned Stevfest and all these things, because you were also director of summer camps for a long time.
Yes.
You too. So you had spent a lot of time putting these things together for kids.
Yes, and a lot of planning. That is something that I have really enjoyed doing and that I look forward to doing a little bit more. I've actually just was talking with the outreach people the other day about having some physics camps now that I'm with the physics department. So I'm looking to get back into those types of things. But yes, just designing those types of experiences for the kids and wrapping it around a theme was always something that I really, really enjoyed. I think the very first camp we had that had that sort of a layout was our engineering amusement camp, which was one that I inherited from Patty when I started. That was one that she had already been running. But that one was all themed around amusement parks. So all of the different activities we would be doing would have some tie-in with amusement parks. So we would do confection science and learn how cotton candy and Dippin' Dots are made. We would study the forces that are applicable to certain types of rides, whether they're spinning rides or dropping rides or your roller coasters. And we would talk about kinetic and potential energy. And then we'd actually top it off by going and doing a day full of experiments. You can't see the air quotes I'm doing on the radio. But we would spend the day doing experiments, which basically meant riding the rides and being conscious about the things and thinking about things. We wouldn't have them actually filling out worksheets while they're on the rides. But
I would like to see that, though.
Now, there are high school classes that do this. Six Flags actually has a whole day where they have high school students come out and they have sensor packs that they wear and they actually collect data. We were dealing with younger kids, so we didn't go quite that far. It was more conceptual questions that we were asking them. But just really getting them to think about what's going on when they're on those rides and that physics is part of life. Is something that I think is very, very important and something that I really tried to wrap into all of the different camps that I designed.
Oh, I love that the sensors that you could put on the rides too. Mm-hmm. Like that's something like I grew up as a kid. Like I wasn't, you know, science wasn't my favorite class, but I was a huge sports kid. You know, talk about the Cubs right there. I was a huge baseball fan, right? And like I was obsessed with like sports statistics. So like I could totally see myself as a kid getting wrapped up in like where you have those sensors and you're analyzing that data. I forget what it's called. We had a physics teacher on the show just last year or 2 years ago now. And they were talking about how they had these like little boxes. I forget what they're actually called, but that they can send home with kids where they can use to, you know, measure different forces and they can, you know, put it, you know, they can attach it to their car and, you know, stop and they can, you know, feel their, you know, measure all those things. They could put it on a swing, all that sort of stuff.
Well, and one of the amazing things now with technology and the advancement of all of our devices is we used to have to give the kids those types of devices.
Yeah.
Nowadays we're trying to keep them in their lockers. They've all got one in their phone. There's accelerometers. Oh, yeah. Everything that we are handing out to those kids is in the smartphone nowadays. So actually, now that I think about when the last time I was at Six Flags just this fall with another physics teacher friend of mine, they were no longer handing out those sensor packs. The kids just used their phones to collect all of the data.
Oh,
so that is really neat in that technology has become much more accessible. And what teachers used to have to buy a classroom set of and maintain and replace is now something that kids just have in their pocket. So I am a big fan of teaching them to use those tools constructively.
Yeah.
I completely understand leaving it in your locker during class. It's a huge distraction. I'm not saying that, you know, that is a problem. But at the same time, I think teaching them to use those tools not just abuse them or use them as distractions, but to use them constructively is something that, that is very important and can have a big impact on their ability to grasp these things and to interact with them on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, like obviously technology's changed a ton in the last 10, 15 years, which coincides perfectly with your time as a science educator and communicator. I'm sure that's if you've had to evolve probably your thinking about, you know, when you can, you're not necessarily, you know, the gatekeeper of information anymore. People can look up anything they want. They can look up, you know, whatever formulas they want to look up or stats or figures. Mm-hmm. And so now the unique, A, you can use the technology, but also you have to think about what are the things that still make us unique. And obviously one of those things is the hands-on stuff.
Yes. Well, and I like what you said there about but being the gatekeepers of information, because that's something that I've always felt very personal about as a teacher myself. And I think that that kind of helps move things in a direction that I'd like to see them go, is that a lot of people kind of view teachers as like the guru on the mountain, that the keeper of the
sage
information,
on the stage.
As you said. Exactly.
Right.
And I am not a big fan of that outlook. Yeah. I prefer to think of us not as the guru on top of the mountain. We are the Sherpas helping people up. We are not the font of wisdom. I am not infallible by any means. But I maybe have more experience going up than some people have. Yeah. I can offer some tips and advice, but ultimately you're going to find the knowledge yourself. All I'm doing is leading you there.
Is that something that was just kind of intuitive to you as you started off, or is that another thing that you kind of learned by trial and error?
That's a very good question. I think some of it has been internal. I've always had that kind of philosophy of that you know, there is no grand expert. We are all just kind of here helping each other through it.
Yeah.
I think I've had a lot of good role models that have helped kind of present that model as well.
Right. Because a lot of us do grow up thinking that the teacher is, you know, the ultimate sage on the stage. They're, you know, obviously like parent figures in a lot of ways too. So like, how dare you question the information that they're presenting to you? Obviously that becomes different when you become the person who's teaching.
Well, and that's a big focus of critical thinking as well, is the idea that arguments from authority are not necessarily watertight. You know, just because someone is an authority, if you've got proof that they're wrong, that proof is heavier than their word. You know, the authorities are constantly being overturned. The current understanding of things is constantly being overturned, which is not a flaw. That is the most important feature of science, that it is constantly self-correcting. So some people I've heard kind of say, oh, well, science, you know, one year we say this is good, and the next year we say that's bad, and now this is good, and so we can't trust them. Well, I think it's completely the opposite. Because we are constantly reevaluating and weighing new evidence, our opinions do change, and they should change. We should grow and expand our understanding as we gain new information.
Yeah, if things were the same for 100 years, you'd be like, is anyone doing anything? Yeah. Are we still checking stuff?
I mean, once upon a time, science said we should cut off limbs and use leeches. I mean, that's, I don't think we want to go back to that, but we have evolved. So we now know things that we did not know then, and we have better ways to approach things. And by that same token, 100 years from now, we're going to look back at the way we do things now, and they're going to seem archaic.
I know. Well, I mean, I even think about that from like a 5 to 10 year lens, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what am I doing right now? Or what are the things that we're thinking right now that in 10 years we're going to be like, man, that's aged poorly. I can't believe we were doing that.
I think that every time I go to the dentist, you know, you think about like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I mean, even 5, 10 years ago, you know, going to the dentist was torturous. And a lot of people kind of still have that mentality. Yeah. It's like, oh, I'm going in, I got to get a cavity done. But you know what, anymore, I just sit there and listen to my headphones, and 20, 30 minutes, it's over, and I go on with my life. And
the
it's
headphones
not,
has changed a lot, right?
That definitely helps. But yeah, just the technology, the tools, it makes things so much easier and less traumatic, and particularly in dentistry, I think, is the trauma response, their stigma. But just in all forms of science and medicine, just this advance of knowledge and technology has allowed us to do things that seemed like magic. Yeah. 50, 100 years ago. And so to me, that's really inspiring and just kind of just amazing to think about. If 50, 100 years from now, what's it, the things that seem like magic to us are going to be commonplace.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, the summer camps and things like that, and about how hands-on activities are something that makes STEM really unique. And I was curious for you, as someone who is, you know, a science communicator, science educator now, when you were a kid and when you were in those science classes, did it feel like that for you? Were you guys doing a lot of hands-on, or did it feel very traditional sage on the stage to you when you were in those classes?
I think I've had experiences with both. However, yeah. I think I have always gravitated towards the more hands-on experience.
Sure, sure, sure.
So I was always building things, taking things apart, doing experiments myself as a kid. My mom loves talking about how I would take apart lamps and things like that. And then or I remember taking apart my toys to see what was going on inside. I had a toy train that I remember I just completely disassembled because I wanted to see all the gears and like what is going on inside of this.
Probably less frightening for your mom than the lamp was.
Yeah, probably. Hopefully the lamp wasn't plugged in when this happened. But so I've always had that sort of curiosity and that innate desire myself to experiment, to test, to try things out to get a feel for it. And the learning experiences I've had that I think have been most impactful also follow along with that. Like I was lucky enough to go to space camp when I was young, and I still remember a lot of the hands-on experiences that we did in that, different experiments, and basically what would be, you know, simple physics labs or chemistry labs, but everything kind of was put into that theme, like I said, of the space camp, which I think is a really great way to grab attention and garner excitement.
For sure.
I've also had my share of teachers that just stood in the front of the room and talked, and there is value to that. I don't say that that's a bad method of teaching. It's not my favorite method of teaching, but there are definitely some people who get overwhelmed by all the hands-on and things. So there are different learning and different teaching styles, and I'm not going to fault anyone or say that anyone is better than another, but I've definitely, I think in those situations is when I have really learned that the learning, the work has to be done by me. The teachers are there to help, to guide, to offer information and inspiration, but ultimately, you have to be the one doing the work.
Like you said, Sherpa up the mountain, they can provide a helping hand, they can guide you up there, but ultimately, you have to do the stepping.
But they're not going to drag you up for you. there's a Simpsons reference in there somewhere. But yeah, so I have always enjoyed those opportunities where I really could get in and do things and take more charge of the learning myself. And even in situations where it was more of I use the word passive for lack of a better term, presentation, where the teacher is just in the front of the room, I think that's helped reinforce that notion that I do have to be responsible for my own learning. And if I don't understand what they're saying, it's on me to ask questions. If it still doesn't make sense, it's on me to read the book and find the answers to those questions. They can help you, but they can't push the information into your head.
Right. And in some ways, you know, as a teacher too, you're trying to figure out ways to encourage students to be confident, to be, you know, confident in asking those questions and in bringing those to you.
Yes. And for me, the engagement is a big part of that. If you've got kids that are interested in what you're talking about, they will ask those questions. Like you mentioned with the sports statistics and things. I've used that example a lot because I've heard so many parents make comments similar to, oh, well, you know all of these baseball statistics. You know all of this. It's no different than math. Why can't you do your math homework? Well, and that's exactly it, because the baseball, all of that has the story wrapped around it. It has something that's enticing that brings people in. I love pure math. I am under no illusion that everyone else does. So you need to have some type of a story, some type of spoonful of sugar to help I hate to use the term medicine because that makes it sound negative, and that's not at all what I'm saying. But to use the analogy, something to kind of sweeten the deal.
Sometimes you have to haunt the physics lab.
Sometimes you have to haunt the physics lab, exactly.
And so science was always something that you were interested in.
Always.
You were always passionate about it since you were a kid. What about science teaching? We always ask people about their kind of teacher origin story. Is it something that early on you knew that you wanted to potentially be a science teacher? Is that something that came to you later on? Like, what was that track like?
It's something I think I considered early on. I remember the first time I remember it crossing my mind was in fifth grade. And oddly enough, it was with a teacher I did not care for. And I think maybe the impetuous there might have been that I thought I could do better.
Yeah. It's always, I want to be this teacher I had, or I want to be the teacher that I did not have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I know it's something that I had considered on and off for a good deal of time. I remember I was out with a friend one night, and I had pretty much just at this point in my life decided science was more just a personal passion and a hobby. I had done several other types of warehouse jobs and things like that. And I was out with a friend one night, and I was telling him all about something I had read in a physics book. And he looks me square in the eye, and he says, you know, if you got a job as a physics teacher, you could get paid to tell people who don't care all about this stuff. And he was being a bit of a jerk, he struck a bit of truth there. And the more I thought about that, I was like, you know, I do really love learning about this stuff, and I really love sharing it and telling other people about it. And while he was kind of jokingly telling me, hey, I don't care, let's talk about something else. Mm-hmm. I think that comment really is kind of what started the fire. And not long after that, I signed up for the teaching program at NIU.
Where were you at in your life at that point?
So my first degree, I have a bachelor's in communications. I have always been fascinated by media, by radio and television. Early on, I thought maybe I would go into a career in radio. So I've always loved coming here to the station and getting to work with you guys. I almost kind of thought about doing advertising for a while. I had been told by many people I was very creative and good at coming up with these types of things and could be very persuasive. I only stuck with that for about a semester and decided advertising was not for me. It felt a little bit like psychological warfare. Just a bit too aggressively trying to separate fools from their money, which happens normally. You don't have to try that hard. So from there, I kind of started moving towards the media in general, and less emphasis on the advertising, because I started kind of thinking about how those messages are shared and the effect that they have on us, which is something that's always been very fascinating to me as well. So my first degree is in video production and interpersonal communication, with a heavy emphasis on media and how we use the media to influence and to spread messages and just the effect that it's had on our culture as a whole. Which is something that I really like thinking about and talking about.
Yeah.
And then from there, I went on and got the physics degree and the teaching certification because I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with the communications degree. I love having it, and I'm glad that I do. I think it has definitely been a benefit in my science career, being a communicator, and kind of understanding how those different types of media reach their audience. But yeah, the teaching, I think, is really where all of that was leading.
Oh, interesting. I love, though, that you had the communication background. And hopefully that felt like it gave you a bit of an advantage when you were going into the teaching because you had that background in communication.
Absolutely, yeah. Just kind of understanding how messages are received, the things like difficulty in encoding and decoding. You know, just because I have said it clearly doesn't mean you're going to understand it clearly. Just because there is no noise in between, there are still so many ways. I mean, even just the concept of speaking is so amazing when you really stop and think about it. I do this thing with my throat where I vibrate some air and that those vibrations reach you, and I can say something like, imagine a hippopotamus in a pink tutu. And just by doing this strange thing with my throat and vibrating some air, how many people out there right now are picturing a hippopotamus in a pink tutu?
It's very cute.
That is powerful. And with that great power comes great responsibility. So that is something that I have always been very conscious of, just the power of words and the impact that communication can have on people. And I think that anybody who has that ability to reach people like that has a responsibility to use it to make the world a better place.
It's fascinating, and I've had the pleasure to have a couple physics teachers on the show in the last couple of years, and one of the common themes that I feel like every single one of them brings up and feels like they have to hammer, the theme is always that they want to make sure people know that science is for everyone and that everyone can do science. And it reminds me of what we were talking about a little bit earlier with, you know, sometimes you need to haunt the physics lab. Sometimes you need to add a little bit of sweetener to help people get there, even though they might be inherently interested in things like sports statistics or something. But it's still something that so many teachers feel like they have to say in STEM or in science fields to make sure, hey, guys, like everyone can do this. Science is for everyone. I'm curious for you as someone that also does this, and I've heard you say a version of that as well, that it's still something that science teachers feel like they really need to hammer to make sure that people know, hey, this isn't just for some exclusive, like, elite class of people who maybe love the pure math without the sweetener. But that's something that it feels like is always brought up a little bit when I get to talk with these teachers.
Absolutely. I think there is, unfortunately, a common stigma that science is, and particularly physics and mathematics, are they're only for that certain type of people, that true nerd. That
the Einsteinification of physics,
sort of
right? That you have to be.
Outcasty type people.
Yeah.
And as much as I love the show Big Bang Theory, I kind of feel like things like that almost kind of help reinforce that stereotype.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of media. I mean, when you look at all of your smart characters, a lot of them tend to kind of have that sort of outcast, outsider sort of vibe to them. So I think it is very important that we change that stigma. To me, one of the things that I always tell students when I go out to talk to schools is a scientist is just someone who answers questions. No matter what job you have, no matter what your career, no matter what your hobbies, learning how to ask and answer questions effectively is a powerful tool, and it can benefit you. An engineer is someone who solves problems. learning how to look at problems, approach them, and solve them like an engineer is beneficial no matter what career, no matter what you do in your life. So these skills, even if you have no intention of going and getting a job in a lab, even if you know, you know, I want to do this and I'm not going to wind up there, but still embracing those skills, embracing that thinking style makes you a more effective person. It allows us to be able to analyze things and determine what we believe and what we think is probably not worth paying attention to, kind of filter out the noise. It allows us to be able to test things, having that sort of mentality where you can look at something analytically and come up with, okay, it's not working. How can I figure out what's not working about it? That sort of deductive process where we try this. Okay, well, that happened. What does that mean? Being able to go through stepwise like that and use the engineering design cycle, use the scientific method to approach these problems is one of the most powerful tools that we can give students, because no matter what they do, they are going to have questions. They are going to have problems. And so these tools are universal.
It's one of the great gifts I feel like being a journalist offers, which is that it's my job to ask questions about things that I'm curious about, and not only ask them, but actively seek out what the answers to those questions are and then present them to people. And well, it's interesting because I think intuitively you could break that down for kids, right? That science is the scientific method. Science is asking those questions and using those deductive reasoning skills, analyzing evidence, finding a conclusion. Like, I think that makes sense to people and we could kind of understand that, but you have to get from there to then being in a class to show them how you can actually do this.
Which is
almost a different thing too.
In the methodology, I think is such an important part of it. So many people kind of confuse science with the body of knowledge that has been accumulated through the process of science. And like I said, that's constantly changing. We're constantly reevaluating, looking back and saying, hey, maybe we didn't have this quite right.
Right.
But the process has not changed since Newton. This idea of looking at the evidence, following the evidence wherever it leads, asking questions, deducing things from the evidence that we've found, that remains constant. So that is what science is that process. Everything else is what science has gotten us. It's our current, you know, fruits of our labors, which is constantly changing. But the process that's at the core of it, I think, it remains unchanged. And that is what we need to teach our students, is that process.
I think that's a pretty widespread misunderstanding that people have.
I personally am a big proponent of the idea that facts can be looked up. We are in an age of information. We almost have too much information available at our fingertips.
I'll stand on that hill.
the more important thing is to teach them how to parse through this information, how to use that scientific process to evaluate the information. The information's out there. I don't think it's constructive to be teaching kids to memorize things. There are certain things, you know, they need to know their phone number. There are certain things that are worth memorizing. But I think it's much more important and much more powerful to give them the tools to solve the problems themselves and to give them tools that are adaptable enough that they can be customized to solve almost any problem rather than just giving them the answer and being like, this is the answer to that problem. This is the answer to this problem. They need the tools to solve them and to solve problems that they have not yet anticipated, that we have not yet anticipated as a society even.
And those are the things that you take with you. Those are the things that people really remember about school, things that actually impact them. Nobody's like, man, when I think back about school, it was really Algebra 1 when we memorized slope-intercept form. Like, that was really the thing that made me want to be a teacher. You know what I mean? Like, it's the hands-on stuff. It's, you know, using these skills to analyze a problem that I'm actually interested in, that I'm actually curious about.
Yes. And kind of along those lines, another memory that just brought to mind, the moment I knew, I think, that I wanted to do the outreach type stuff.
So
I had worked with several different summer camps and types of things, and I would always try to put in, like, an educational twist on it. I've always been very passionate about sharing what I've learned and getting kids excited about that kind of stuff. So I was always trying to do these science activities and experiments and things with just a regular summer camp, which did not take quite as well. And then not long after that, I started working at the summer camp. So I met Patty and she came in and was looking for people to help out with the science camps over the summer. And I was kind of like, hey, these kids might actually want to do these science activities that I've been excited about. And so after my first summer working with her, her and I were kind of talking, cleaning things up, and she was talking to me about my goals and what I was studying and what my plans were for after graduation. And I told her originally I had gone to school to start working on a teaching certificate to become a middle school science teacher. But after spending that summer working with her, I decided I wanted her job.
I'm coming for the throne, actually. Yeah.
Well, not necessarily like I'm coming for you, but like I want in on this.
Yes,
how can I be part of this? Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, I started working with the summer camps after that. Not long after that, became the first full-time employee of the STEM outreach program, which was still very new at that time. And yeah, things just kind of snowballed from there. And within a couple years, I was going out all over Northern Illinois doing physics demonstration shows, setting up hands-on exhibits with all of these physics interactive demonstrations and stations. And so, yeah, it really kind of just was a matter of being in the right place at the right time and saying the right thing to the right person.
And so you mentioned that that led you to be able to go do demonstrations across Northern Illinois. It also eventually led you to go even further than that.
Yes. So we have presented at several different AAPT meetings throughout the country, met with different physics teachers, lab managers, and things like that, and shared different ideas with them. We have also been lucky enough to travel overseas. So through the camps, we were introduced to this group that brings students to America from China to participate in different camps, really high-level camps, things like NASA's Space Camp, Michael Jordan's Basketball Camp. So we were very lucky to get included in this pool of camps that these students were being brought over for. And through that relationship, we actually were invited to go over to China to help work and do professional development with some of their teachers. So Patty originally went over first on her own and did a couple weeks there working with students. And then we decided that it would be more effective for us to work with the teachers and then let the teachers work with all of their students, because each teacher has access to as many students as we would have been able to interact with on our own.
Yeah.
So from there, our model changed to doing more professional development with the teachers and really teaching them about this hands-on STEM philosophy, the idea of learning through doing, which was really a lot of fun. Also a very interesting experience, very different from any other teaching I've ever done.
How so?
Because they don't speak the same language.
Well, yeah.
So there were some that knew a little bit of English, but mostly everything had to go through translators. Which is a bit of a challenge because translation can be a tricky sort of process at best. And when you're dealing with highly technical language with highly specific terms. So, for example, when we'd be talking about critical thinking in the idea of looking at ideas critically, we realized early on that there was a bit of a translation issue there and that they took it to mean that we were like criticizing.
Like criticism,
students,
right.
Which, you know, really got me thinking about the root of the words, and there is some similarities and tie-ins there, but really the connotation is much different. Obviously, we do not want to be like dismissing our students or talking down to them, but we do want to be challenging them and sort of that, you know, realizing that the word itself is not enough. We need to make sure that we have a lot of background and context for those words.
Yeah.
So every night we would spend going through the plan for what we were going to talk about tomorrow and kind of re-explaining it and trying to give different perspectives on it just to make sure that they really understood like how we were using these words to avoid those types of misunderstandings. So it was really a very informative and illuminating process. And I think all of us came out understanding what we were doing much better for it.
Yeah. But luckily, it's maybe some of those hands-on things, like once you're able to communicate far enough to where you can, you know, maybe show something like hands-on, then it's something that like just intuitively people can start to connect the dots to.
Yes. And it was great seeing these teachers really open up because at the risk of sounding stereotypical, the situation that they seemed to come from was very much where the students were being presented with the material, with the equations, being expected to find solutions, but not having as much of that hands-on interaction and getting to actually play with the things and figuring out what can be done with it, what, you know, just the exploration of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, if you found it to be your experience and the perspective you are coming into teaching science through playing and doing, if that seemed to be something that they had context for, if that was something that they were just starting to open up to a little bit in their experience? Or?
It did seem to be less familiar to them than it was to us. I know one example, and this is one of Patty's examples from when she was there with the students, but we do an activity with neutral buoyancy where we would have a balloon, a slightly inflated balloon, and then paper clips, pipe cleaners, washers, really whatever you happen to have lying around. The rest of it is not as important, but things that can then be attached to this balloon. Some things might be heavier, more dense. Some things like the pipe cleaners might actually collect some air bubbles and have a bit of buoyancy themselves. And the idea is to construct, using all of these pieces, something that is neutrally buoyant, something that we can place in a beaker of water that will stay at whatever point we put it at, that is floating at the same rate it is sinking, and so it just stays in place. And it's virtually impossible to do perfectly. We end up timing how long it takes to float or sink, and the slower the better. So after all of this information had been presented, that the goals had been outlined, one of the students, you know, raises his hand and says, well, teacher, you haven't given us the densities of any of these materials. We can't calculate. We don't know how much of anything to add. And she just kind of chuckled a little, like, I could give you all of the densities, but it's not going to help as much as you think it might. You have to just try it. You got to put things on and take things off and play around with it. And so that was very different for them than the style of learning they had been used to. And I really think, and Patty and I agree on this, that is a very important part of it, because things don't ever go according to theory. Things don't ever go just according to plan. That perfect situation isn't ideal, but you need to learn to deal with the real world and the things that will pop up.
And that's also playing too, right? Like when you're doing that experiment for fun, if things are a little bit off, that's not an, oh God, we messed up. How did we fail? You're just like, all right, well, take one piece off. See if we can make it flow. You know, that's just a part of the experience rather than it being something you're trying to avoid.
Exactly. And that goes back to that Mr. Rogers quote of play being the work of childhood. When they are playing, when they are having fun, they are naturally learning. They are absorbing. They are excited about it. And they remember what they've learned. Whereas if we're just force feeding them this information, they may remember it long enough to take the test, but there's no excitement. There's no discovery there. So it just kind of goes in one ear and out the other, I think, more often than not. So having that joy, that ownership of the discovery, I think is something that's very important. I'm a big fan of when I'm going around and helping students with things. I don't ever want to point out if I see a problem with their lab or their procedure. I don't necessarily want to just say, hey, this is incorrect. You want to guide them to that discovery themselves. Well, hey, I like what you're doing here, but when the ball gets to this part of the track, what's going to happen? And then they stop and they look at, oh, there's nothing supporting there. It's going to fall off. And they come to that discovery and then they own the knowledge from it. Whereas if I just came up and said, it's going to fall off right there, they'll fix it, but they might not think about it again. And they don't really learn from that. They might take it with them, but it doesn't have the same impact as when they make the discovery, when they have ownership of it. One of my favorite memories is when I teach a lot, I have my collection of science-themed bow ties that I either wear. I am a big fan of Bill Nye's idea. You know, bow ties are great. They don't dangle in your soup. They don't get into your experiments. They're perfect for scientists. So every day I had a different colorful science-themed bow tie on. And the last day of our two-week session when I was there on my own, one of the ladies had made paper bow ties for everyone, and they all did a big group picture with me, and they all had their little bow ties on, and I still have that picture, and it was just one of the most touching things, and it really showed me that they appreciated me and that they appreciated everything that we had been doing, and that is an experience I am very grateful to have been able to add.
Yeah, that'd be really cool if you get an opportunity like that again at some point.
I hope I do. That was something.
What are some of your favorite keys for like an unforgettable science camp? Like what are things that you like to do to really blow someone's mind? Maybe that'll be the thing that really, you know, makes them passionate about science.
That's a really good question because it's a little bit different for everybody.
Sure,
I would say that it's kind of more of a general answer. I feel like maybe it's a bit of a cop-out, but I would say the thing that I have tried to do is find ways to connect with each student as much as possible. Because everybody has different interests. Everybody's going to resonate with something different.
For sure.
So I kind of have my idea of what I think most of the kids will resonate with. And generally, I think that we've done a pretty good job of picking topics and activities that are engaging and exciting for the kids.
Everyone loves a light sword.
Yeah, exactly. But then the trick is that, you know, you can't just throw that out there and then expect it to stick with everyone. You have to be paying attention. You have to be watching the class. You have to be gauging the interaction. And if there is those kids that didn't resonate with the way you want it to, you've got to get in there and find a way to either make it resonate or find some other way to get them engaged, because you don't want to have kids like, oh, well, this wasn't what I wanted to do. Well, that happens sometimes, but you still need to find a way to get everybody engaged as much as possible. And I think that level of attention is something that the kids really appreciate, knowing that there is somebody there that wants to see them succeed, that isn't just standing at the front of the room going through the motions. And that is, to me, something that I feel that I have gotten a lot of response from, something that I feel that has been appreciated, and I hope so anyways.
Yeah, that like just passion and enthusiasm can really help people open themselves up to the experience they have, knowing, again, that you really care about something, that you're really excited about it, even if it's something that they might not inherently be interested in, it can at least get you started.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I always tell our TAs, our teaching assistants now in the physics department, every time we do our meetings with them, is that it's important to be enthusiastic. It's important to be excited about the subject because you set the bar for enthusiasm in your classroom.
Yeah.
Very rarely will you have a student who's more into the subject than you are. It's great when it happens, but
yeah,
don't hold your breath. So if you are walking in and you sort of have this bored look and you're just sort of conducting yourself as though this is tedium and you're just going through the steps, your students are going to pick up on that and they're going to feel like it's tedium and they're going to feel like they are just going through the steps. If you walk in excited about the material and happy to be doing what you're doing and that shows on your face and they can feel that, that excitement is contagious. They can't help but have more fun and be more engaged. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all going to then become physics majors, but I think if you walk in and you kind of have the facade yourself that this is not where I want to be, this is not what I want to be doing right now, you can't expect the students to feel any different.
No, definitely not. And I'm sure you have, though, over the last, you know, during your career, had a few experiences where you have seen some light bulb moments, or you have seen some moments where a student who maybe wasn't, again, super interested coming in, whether it be at a camp or in a class, that something really connected with them.
Oh yes. And those light bulb moments are some of my very favorite things. When you have a kid that is maybe struggling with something or feels kind of left out or doesn't feel like they're really part of it yet, and then suddenly whatever happens, something clicks, someone reaches out to them, just all of a sudden that change, that smile lights up, and then everything from there is just much easier. I think getting to that breakthrough point where they kind of are just, they let go and just let it happen and let themselves enjoy it, mm-hmm. is one of the most powerful tools for learning. That's something. Mr. Rogers is one of my biggest influences. And he has always been big on that learning is, or play is play is the work of childhood.
Yeah.
I believe is his quote, that if we can make them have fun with these things, kids are sponges. They are constantly learning whether we are teaching them or not. The idea is to get them excited about what we want to learn, and then they will absorb it. They're going to be absorbing something. So the trick is to just kind of point them in the direction that you want them to be and get them engaged where they move forward on their own.
And again, your own enthusiasm really helps get you there too.
Yes, that will inspire. And then if they're having fun, before you know it, they're telling somebody else about what they've learned, and now they're teaching. And as a teacher, that is the best thing. Once you actually can explain what you've learned to somebody else, you know you understand it. So when I see kids...
Like a torch being passed,
exactly.
Right?
When I see kids at the end of the day talking to their parents about what they've learned and what they did and explaining it, or when we've seen students give presentations at the end of camps, and there's been several times where I'm like, they just explained that better than I did. And that warms my heart because they have taken ownership of that discovery, and that is the most important thing.
Yeah, I love that, and especially with the... you know, students explaining things better than you could, right? Like, I think you're completely right. I think about even my own life, or if you watch a show that you really love, or like I'm reading a book right now, and I can tell that it's really landing because it feels like twice a day I'm going over to my girlfriend and like explaining things that happened and trying to relay that information that you're right. Like that spark of learning kind of makes you try to share that, right? You're so excited that you don't want to keep it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some really exciting moments.
Definitely.
That's awesome. And so right now, your title is that you are the lab manager, correct?
Lab manager and unofficial outreach coordinator for the physics department.
And for folks that don't know, what is a lab manager?
So my responsibilities are overseeing all of the labs, so making sure the equipment is all working, making sure that our teaching assistants have all the materials that they need and are properly trained and have everything that they need to be able to handle the students, ordering equipment. And then my favorite lab that I get to be in charge of and kind of my main outreach outlet at the moment is our observatory. So
yes.
Northern Illinois.
I was going to ask about that, yes.
We do have a nice big observatory up on top of Davis Hall. I say big. It is a fairly large telescope. It is not a fairly large room. We can only fit about 20 people up in there, and even then it gets pretty crowded. So the observatory had been closed since the pandemic. When I took over the physics department or the physics labs a couple years ago, that was one of my first priorities, was to get that back open again. And so we did a big grand reopening party. We had a couple hundred people show up, and I'm actually glad that it ended up being cloudy that night because we had so many people that were lined up down the stairs, and I felt bad because there wasn't really anything to look at that night because it was cloudy. But like I said, that was sort of a saving grace because we had so many people. So we just aimed the telescope at the NIU water tower, and I'm like, there's a Husky. See, next. There's a Husky. Next. Okay. Whereas if we had actually been doing a tour and looking at three or four things throughout the night, it would have taken much longer to get everybody through. So one of the things that along those lines that we've added recently, and it's not the first time we've had one of these, but it's a newer one that I'm more familiar with, is we have a nice digital camera now that is basically an eyepiece that fits into the telescope. So we can now take photographs, do live streaming video of events. So like when we had bigger events like the lunar eclipse and the solar eclipse a little over a year ago, we were able to live stream those so we didn't have to have a line of people all the way down the stairs to the ground. Because things like that, you know, eclipse, really the best part only lasts for a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah.
So it's not the kind of thing where we can feasibly get everybody upstairs and have a chance to look at it themselves. As well as the fact that the observatory is not entirely accessible. There are quite a few stairs that you have to deal with to get up there.
Yeah.
So being able to share our views and share that experience with people that may not be able to make it up to the observatory is also something that I really am glad that we can do.
Yeah. And the observatory is open to the public, too.
It is. Right now, our public hours are Wednesdays from 8 to 10 p.m., once the time change happens and it's dark a little earlier, we will probably move that up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But for right now, it is Wednesdays from 8 to 10. If the skies are clear, we are up there.
What are the showstoppers? What are at least the things that you get to when people come up there? Like, they definitely have to see this before they leave, assuming it's not super cloudy.
Yeah. So we do have quite a bit of light pollution here in DeKalb. We are conveniently located between Naperville, Aurora, Rockford, Chicago, lots of bright lights.
Yeah.
So it never gets completely dark, as well as the campus being well lit for safety. So we are limited to some of the brighter objects. So the planets and the moon are some of our very favorite things to look at. The moon really is my hands down favorite because even though we see it all the time and maybe take it for granted, it is the closest thing to us and the only thing that's close enough for us to really see surface details on. So when we look at planets or other things like that, we can see stars and they just look like a little pinpoint of light. The planets we can resolve as disks and maybe see some of the atmosphere. We can see the color bands on Jupiter. We can see the rings of Saturn, which are very impressive. But we can't actually see the surface of those planets. We are just seeing the atmosphere. We can see the surface of Mars, but no real details. On a really good night, you can make out the polar ice caps, but that's about it. Whereas the moon, we can actually study in depth these craters and ridges. We can point out the different seas and mares versus the rougher areas. We can identify where the different Apollo missions landed. So there's just a lot more to look at and to appreciate, I think, looking at the moon. That said, I think my very favorite thing, though, would be the Orion Nebula, which is more of a fall-winter viewing. But that is a nebula which is in the constellation of Orion. It's just a little bit below the three stars of the belt. And so that is a cloud of gas and dust in space, most likely the remnants from some previous star which has exploded and sort of scattered its components throughout this area, which then condenses and new stars form out of that gas. And so it is a stellar nursery. New stars are being born in there and kind of drifting off and starting their own lives. And it's just very beautiful. It looks like a sort of cloud floating in space with these little twinkling lights inside of it. They're just, I really enjoy looking at nebulas.
It's hard to get a cooler phrase than stellar nursery, too. That's another thing, too, about science, right? Like, we have all these things around us that we take for granted that we see all the time, like the moon that you mentioned, where you're like, actually, take a step back. Zoom out just a little bit. It's insane that we can see this. It's insane that, you know, we're on this rock at all. So let's take a little bit of time to actually analyze, actually think about these things on a deeper level and appreciate how insane it is that any of us are here right now at all.
Exactly, exactly. One of the things that I've said to students as well is that looking at the world around us, I've compared it to listening to a song in a language you don't understand. You can hear the melody, you can appreciate the beauty, you can enjoy it. It could even be your favorite song. But if you learn that language, then all of a sudden you know what the song is about. You understand the subcontext, you understand the true meaning of it, you get it on a deeper level. So we can appreciate the world around us just like that song, but it is written in the language of math and science. And if we can actually appreciate it on that level, all of a sudden we start noticing things that weren't there before. We start appreciating on a much deeper level, and it gains a much more sort of robust existence. And so that, to me, is the true beauty of it. It is The analyzing and understanding is great, and the act of actually doing the math is very satisfying to me. But at the end of the day, I like just looking back and being in awe of it all and seeing how all of these things are just infinitely woven together in such an intricate just pattern and reality that everything depends on everything else. And it's just really awe-inspiring to me just to kind of see those connections and appreciate just everything that goes into things that we, like you said, take for granted and just see every day and let wash over us until we actually stop and think. Like my example with the talking. You know, we talk constantly all day, every day, and how often do we really stop and think about just how amazing a process that really is? What's really going on in terms of us encoding a message, that vibrating air reaching someone else, and then our minds decoding it, interpreting it through the lens of everything we've experienced? I could say the same sentence to 10 different people and have it interpreted 10 different ways. So all of that is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people, and maybe especially younger people, it can be embarrassing to really let that awe, let it wash over you. You know, I think that it's almost like a little cringe to like really be like, oh my God, I can't believe that, or be like these same conversations. Like, can you believe how crazy it is that we're able to even communicate with each other, or that we're on a planet or the moon is there? But that's, you know, a part of education that we can do is to let people in on that this is, you know, not only is it okay, but like having passion about these things, it's so cool to be able to connect with these things.
And I think there's a vulnerability there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, there's vulnerability
having
too, right.
that genuineness and that awe. Yeah. Because if you're open to learning these new things, you might learn things you don't like. You might learn things that disagree with things you've previously felt were true.
Yeah.
So there is a certain vulnerability there that I think is important. But I think that's integral to curiosity. I mean, to be curious, you have to be a little vulnerable. You have to be willing to accept the results of the exploration.
We always ask people if there are educators they've had, either they could be coworkers, they could be teachers you had growing up, they could be coach, anything that falls underneath the educator umbrella, just educators who've inspired you and you feel like helped you get to where you're at today.
I have so many. I actually made some notes here because I wanted to make sure I remembered as many of the important ones as I can. One of the very first that comes to my mind was my first communications teacher at Aurora University when I started my comms degree, who was Laurel Church, who is just a brilliant, very wise woman. And she was one of the people that really kind of, I think, helped me, my intellectual awakening and in that realization that it is on me, that I am the one that has to do the work, and that the more work I'm willing to put in, the more results I'll see. And so that really kind of helped change my outlook on school and my role in my own education, as well as she was just a fascinating individual, just someone that I still look back fondly on our conversations that we had, and just someone that I felt really kind of understood where I was coming from and where I was going and was very encouraging of that. So that was very important to me. Mrs. Vickers in our my high school, who was our yearbook supervisor, was one of the first people I remember really kind of putting me in a leadership position as an editor for our yearbook and video yearbook.
Nice.
And so I definitely appreciate that, because that is something that leadership experience is something I've taken with me and has grown. And without those early steps and people trusting me in those types of position, I don't know that I would have wound up leading camps and doing the types of things I've done, leading education and professional development sessions in China and things like that, you know, all from those very simple first responsibilities in my high school days, I think. At Northern Illinois University, Patty Sievert, I mentioned, was the head of the outreach department and founder of STEM Outreach when I started. She is still a very close friend of mine and somebody that I hold very dear. And just her passion for education. And I think the two of us are very much in the same page of our idea that outreach should be something different from what they experience in school. We both kind of had the mindset that what we are doing should work in tandem with what the kids are doing in school. We should be augmenting what the teachers are doing. The teachers are there to present the things, and they have lesson plans, and they have standards, and they have things that they are bound to. Whereas we had the freedom to be a little bit more creative, a little bit more free form with the way we would present things and the pace we would present things. And I think both things are important, because learning for the sake of learning is truly one of the most beautiful human experiences I think there is. And unfortunately, just due to the way the school is structured, it's not always possible to embrace that as fully as I would like it to be. And I do understand the need for standardization and some of the, you know, a lot of that stuff. It's a bit of a necessary evil. So I think having both in place, having somewhere where the kids can go and be free to learn at their own pace and to really experience that growth-based learning where it doesn't matter where you start, it doesn't matter where you end, as long as their growth happens in between. I think providing that type of an environment for learning is very, very important, and it works good alongside the other methods where the kids have to go in and there does have to be some tests and they do have to be able to show a certain amount of progress. But if they can look back on these informal experiences and say, hey, I remember this. This is where we did this thing and that cool thing happened.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden that math isn't as intimidating. Having to do the equations or understand it quantitatively isn't quite as scary because you're talking about something that you are fond of, that was exciting for you.
Yeah.
So it kind of breaks down that stigma and makes it more, reduces the resistance, I think, to get through the other method. Yasuo Ito is another one of the physics teachers. He was one of my favorite teachers that I had during my classes, and I'm very lucky to get to work alongside him now as one of my peers. And he is just someone that I feel brings joy to teaching. He is just one of the happiest and most joyful people I've met in general, which is one of my very favorite things about him. And he absolutely brings that joy into the classroom. And that's like I was talking about with the enthusiasm. I don't think I ever had a class with him where I did not leave smiling and happy for the time I had spent with him. And I think that is something that is very important. The kids have to want to be in class. You have to be the kind of person that they want to be around. If they're just counting down the minutes till they can get away from you, they're not learning anything.
Yeah.
So bringing that joy is something that is very, very important to me. And I think he is a marvelous example of that.
I had only a couple more questions I want to go ask you.
Sure.
And we can go through these more rapid fire if we want to. I think that could be fun. We talked a little bit about the different activities, hands-on things that you've gotten to do with kids over the years and camps and stuff like that. And we've talked about the things that, you know, hey, you never know what is going to connect with each student, a different thing. But for you specifically, Jeremy, just do you have a couple favorites of activities or hands-on things that you've got to do over the years?
I think one of my favorites that we did completely ourselves, the musical Tesla coil is definitely a favorite,
That's
but I built that from a kit, so I can't take as much credit for that.
Sure.
But one of my favorite accomplishments that we did truly build ourselves is there was one night, Petey, my former coworker, Petey, and I were kind of sitting around and talking about ideas for exhibits for STEMFest, and we had recently seen Blue Man Group.
Okay.
And decided we needed to build a PVC pipe organ.
Okay, good. I was hoping it wasn't going to be you were going to spit marshmallows in
someone's
hand.
No. not that time.
No.
But so we that night just decided, kind of spur of the moment, at probably like 6 or 7 o'clock or something, maybe earlier than that because we were both still at work, to go to Lowe's and buy all of the supplies. And we pulled an all-nighter. And by 6 o'clock the next morning, we had a PVC pipe organ. And then I went to bed. And that is still, I think, one of our most popular exhibits that we have built because it's hands-on. It's you can hear it. You can feel it. So it involves multiple senses. It's colorful, which I think is all of the hallmarks of a good exhibit. The more senses you can involve, the more interactive you can make it. And kids just love playing with it. Even, you know, we've had kids come up and can just play it as well as a piano, actually make great music. We've had kids just come up and bang on it. And every one of them has just as much fun. I love people seeing come up and just whatever they do, whatever noise or music comes out, it's all music. But whatever comes out, they are having fun. They are learning. They are experimenting. They are seeing what happens when I hit this one. What happens if I hit these two together? And that
That's
is just the purest form of exploration and the joy of it, I think, is watching kids play with that particular piece of equipment.
We've talked about how science is the inquiry. Science is, you know, the method of trying to find these things. It's not just the set of information that has been collected through those means. However, as a science teacher, sometimes you do have to explain, you know, a process or explain maybe a complicated concept in some way and distill that information down. Sometimes you have a student who gets a presentation that can maybe do it a little bit better than you. Do you have, again, talk about just like favorites or concepts that you think people think are way more interesting because, you know, maybe we've just been, you know, conditioned that way that you think, actually, I have a really easy way to distill this down that I kind of enjoy doing.
That's a really good question. Give me a moment to think on that one. I like talking about electricity is one of my favorite particular topics, and I generally equate it to like fluid systems. Which makes very much sense to me.
Yeah.
Electricity in itself is kind of nebulous. A lot of people, we don't see it. We know it's there.
I think you said electricity is lazy earlier, which is also just a very funny phrase that gets sticks in people's minds.
Exactly. And so, yeah, kind of talking about it with those, you know, kind of personalizing it, giving those human qualities like being lazy.
Right.
And then comparing it to a system that people actually understand, like water.
Yeah.
So we have electricity flowing through wires. We have water flowing through pipes. Our voltage in that case is our push or our pull, which would be like how much pressure is behind our water. Resistance would be, you know, if like sticking a sponge in the pipe, we're making it harder for that water to flow through. And then current would be how much water is actually flowing through in terms of gallons per minute. So I think thinking about it in terms of those very kind of commonplace concepts that we see every day around us, that we can apply those same types of models to much more abstract concepts. Which makes it much easier to understand. And yeah, then like I said, I love the concept that electricity is lazy. That's a great way of kind of describing resistance. It would much rather go through the metal. Metal has much less resistance. If you can give it a path where it's going to go through and light up a light bulb versus just going straight across, which would be a short circuit, it's always going to take the short circuit because lighting up that light bulb is work. It doesn't want to have to do more work.
Yeah.
So I think kind of giving it that sort of anthropomorphic quality of laziness is a great way to kind of help kids identify with that what we're talking about, that concept.
You talked about that moment where you were talking your friend's ear off about something and he was like, please stop. Maybe you should do something where you're able to get paid for having these conversations. Is there a science story in the news or just that's been on your mind recently that you can't stop thinking about?
I am kind of fascinated by the idea that our entire universe may exist inside of a black hole.
Really?
I'm still kind of early on reading this. I'm not to the point where I can give you any more of a scientific explanation for it than that. It has to do with the way that the universe appears to be rotating and different things that we have observed about it. And that's just something that's kind of fascinating to me because, you know, does the universe have a boundary? Can you go, if you go far enough in one direction, do you wind up back on the other side? Is it like a video game?
I recently learned about the cosmic microwave background and just it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah, the leftover radiation from the Big Bang.
That you can still see today.
It was accidentally picked up in radio receivers.
Yeah.
Things like those accidental discoveries are marvelous. So that is something that I am very kind of curious about and am interested to see what other things come out. I know there was also a sort of big hubbub earlier, maybe about a year or so ago, maybe a little longer, about the possible discovery of a room temperature superconductor, which kind of it turned out not to be the golden goose that it had originally been hoped to be.
That's science, right?
Yes, exactly.
We worked on it more.
But the fact that you know, we are looking for those things, and throughout human experience, the things we search for, eventually we get there. So these technologies are coming. You know, there's only a matter of time before we do have fusion. You know, we've been 10 years away from it for the last 50 years or so.
When theoretical physics becomes physics.
Yes, but eventually we will unlock fusion, and that will be a exponential increase in the amount of energy that's available to us as a people, and that will greatly change the way that we do things. That understanding more about the nature of the universe and its beginnings, how it got to where it is, where it's going. Those things are coming. Things like room temperature superconductors. We want it bad enough, it's only a matter of time before we figure out a way to do it. And that type of technology is going to completely revolutionize the world around us. So, yeah, I am very excited to see what these discoveries will be, where these right now are sort of potential like science fiction. Because when we look back historically, science fiction has always been the seeds of future science fact.
Also, Room Temperature Semiconductor is like a great band name too, potentially. I have seen that you also have a very fun, very cool lab coat that you wear.
Yes.
That's got a whole bunch of stuff on there. I was curious if that's like one of those things like golf with the Masters where when you win, you get a green jacket. Is it something that like as 10 years as a physics teacher or as a science teacher that you get a fun lab coat? Do you get one immediately after graduation? How does that work?
That was actually one of the very first things that I did when we started with the STEM outreach program. One of the activities we would do with campers was tie-dye because it is a chemical bond. So there is chemistry involved.
Yep.
So I am not by any means the first person to have this thought, but as we're tie-dyeing things, I was like, you know, I'm going to tie-dye a lab coat. And the first one I did, I did a polyester lab coat because that was one of my first experiences with tie-dyeing. And it's very pretty, washed out, cloudy blue, but it doesn't look like a tie-dye is supposed to look like because you can't tie-dye polyester. So my second one was a cotton one, and that is, I think I'm actually on my third one right now, but it has been a evolution of learning to do them better and learning the right materials. And my boss, Patty Sievert, is an artist as well.
Okay,
and so that was something that she was very very involved in the camps, is making sure that art, even before STEAM had become a national thing, I feel that involving art in all of our projects was always something that was very important, because that's what makes it interesting. That's what makes it beautiful. That's what makes, art is what makes things interesting, what makes things worth doing. The science is wonderful, but combining them is what makes it life.
We always ask these questions at the very end, so we've got two more for you, which is the first one, what's just something about science education you wish more people knew?
I think, and it's back to something I already said earlier, that fact that science is for everyone. Whether you have any interest in working in a lab, there is science to be found in everything. Science is just answering questions and finding the answers. Engineering is just solving problems. These things are universal skills. Even if you never want to step foot in a lab, even if you just want to, work on video games. Well, video games are a system. There's logic involved. Things like gravity, the laws of physics have to be incorporated into these games. There are physicists working on video games to ensure that they are realistic. So these things are found everywhere in the world. You can't escape them. And having at least a basic understanding of them will make you better at whatever you try to do.
And then what's something about teaching you wish more people knew?
That is a good question. I would say that is a tough question, because teaching, I think, is such a complex and often misunderstood.
Yeah, it's
role.
Kind of the question that we've been trying to answer over the last like 6 years. So,
I would say something that's not as commonly known or understood is, all right, here's another example or another analogy that I like. Mm-hmm. One thing that I have noticed in my experiences working with different classes and different groups of kids is that kids are all like different little chemical elements, right? Helium has its own properties. Oxygen has its own properties. Carbon has its own properties. All these kids are unique. But then you start putting them together in combinations and new properties emerge. These two kids together have completely different properties than they do separate. You put four of them together. There is absolutely chemistry going on in the classroom and the way that these kids interact with each other. And that is something that has to be accounted for, and that the teachers are constantly observing these reactions and trying to sort of regulate them or sometimes encourage them. And it is a very complex and constantly changing environment. And just, I think, to take a moment to appreciate everything that teachers do and everything that they have to manage and coordinate, because dealing with two or three kids is hard. Dealing with 20, 30 of these individual elements that all have completely different, sometimes unpredictable properties when you put them together. It is amazing. It is beautiful. It is challenging. And ultimately, it is worth it.
Yeah. We say that all the time colloquially, right? Like, people have chemistry. And you're like, yeah, groups have chemistry. They can be volatile. You just be careful with it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jeremy. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've had a blast.
That was my conversation with Jeremy Benson, STEM educator, physics department lab manager, and unofficial outreach coordinator at Northern Illinois University. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Jeremy. Please send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And wherever you're hearing the podcast, please subscribe, leave a rating, share it with a friend. It's the best way to get even more perspectives on the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. And I have been your host, Peter Mudlin, and we'll be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.